Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we're hoping very soon to have with us Pastor David Whitney of the Institute of the Constitution. And every month on this station, I'll have Pastor Whitney back again. In fact, we put him on all of our programs every month, one time, because we feel it's so vitally important that people understand the foundation of our freedom. After all, the reason that we're in the problem we are today is that the average individual has never been taught the Constitution. They don't teach it in high school. They don't teach it in college. They certainly don't teach it in law school. And so most people really have no idea that there is no wall of separation between church and state. I can remember talking to a very well-educated physician who was defending the idea that a wall of separation between church and state. I asked him, well, where in the Constitution is that? And he looked me somewhat surprised, and he said, well, why in the First Amendment? And I said, where in the First Amendment? Well, he didn't know what the First Amendment really said, any more than the average individual understands that we would not have a trouble with our courts if the members of Congress would use their legislative authority under Article 3, Section 2 to limit the appellate jurisdiction of the Supreme Court. So, basically, the problem that we face today is that people really don't understand, and they don't understand because they haven't been taught, and our job is to teach them. And so with that as the background, let's go right now to Pastor David Whitney. Hi, David. How are you?
Good evening, Dr. Stan. Great to be with you. How are you doing?
I'm doing just fine. It's always great to have you. And well, let's go ahead and get into the background of the Constitution, and where were we now? Let's see.
Discussing, actually, we completed the Bill of Rights, and talking about the first 10 amendments that actually were ratified as a block together, because many of the states, when they looked at the Constitution, they said, you know, this is good, but one of the important things it lacks is it lacks the protections that our rights, our God-given rights, are not going to be run over by a strong centralized federal government, and we need a protection against that. And so the Bill of Rights was ratified together as a group in 1791. And as we've talked about before, the design of the Bill of Rights was really to create a wall around the powers of the federal government, only saying that what was inside those walls the federal government could do. Anything outside the walls, the Tenth Amendment said, that was delegated or reserved to the states. Only what the Constitution and the Bill of Rights permitted the federal government to do was it permitted to do. And unfortunately, because as you mentioned, most Americans don't understand the Bill of Rights, and most Americans don't understand the Constitution, the federal government has gotten away with breaking down that wall that was erected wisely by our founding fathers, and now the federal government reaches into every single area of people's lives.
And I think it's so important that people understand that our founding fathers realized that only by limiting the power of government could men be free, that liberty and limited government were synonymous, that tyranny and total government were synonymous, and look the direction we're headed today. We're going to be right back here with Pastor Whitney. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Pastor David Whitney from the Institute of the Constitution. And we're talking about, of course, the mindset of the founding fathers of America. And that was we were basically wanted to have a government of law, a government that would be established, it would be fixed. Law by itself, the very idea of law is that it is fixed, it's not something that can be changed with the whims of men. And some means by which you can control or limit the power of government. For it was John Locke who had said that that government governs best, it governs the least. And so limit the power of the federal government and have matters dealing with life, liberty, and property taken care of at the state and the local level. And if you read the 45th of the Federalist Papers, you'll find that it stipulates there that the powers of the central government will be limited and defined. The powers of the state government, where you deal with life, liberty, and property, will be unlimited and ill-defined. And, of course, then you would have the local community acting as a check on the state government acting as a check on the federal government. And, of course, it was never envisioned by our founding fathers that the federal government would have enough money so that it could bribe the states, as it does with the income tax, because the income tax was specifically forbidden by our founding fathers, who feared the power of central authority. How far we've gotten from there, isn't that right, David?
That's right, and in a sense, when we look at the first 10 amendments, the Bill of Rights, that created the wall surrounding the federal government, limiting its powers and its reach into the lives of the citizens. We find that almost to a T, the rest of the amendments, that is the subsequent amendments after the Bill of Rights, all were in one way, shape, or form undermining or even destroying whole pieces of that wall, liberating the federal government, which is not a good thing, liberating the federal government to invade the lives of the citizens and actually invade the proper jurisdiction of the states. As Article 10 said, the states, and you mentioned Federalist 45, the states were to have wide-ranging, unlimited powers. Federal government was to have very limited powers. Well, today we have that turned on its head, where the federal government has wide-reaching, unlimited powers virtually, and the state governments, well, by and large, they're just political subdivisions of the federal government that have almost no power of their own. The federal government tells them how high to jump, and they go, yes, massa, how high should we jump? We take the first of those, the 11th Amendment, that just 7 years after the ratification of the Bill of Rights, this is 1798, the 11th Amendment was ratified. Now, this amendment actually puts a restriction not so much on the federal government, it really puts a restriction on the states, which again was contrary to the design of the Bill of Rights and the Constitution. And it says that states may not be sued in federal courts.
Hold that thought right there for just a moment, David. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Pastor David Whitney of the Institute of the Constitution. And he was saying that, of course, the whole function of the first 10 amendments was to limit the power of what the federal government could do. Now, the subsequent amendments then, of course, were designed by wicked men to increase the power of government. And even though when many of these the amendments were passed, this was not what the people who voted for them really wanted or intended, or what the American people wanted. But as we've pointed out so many times, there has been, since 1620 or shortly thereafter, when the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth, there have been men who wanted to centralize all power in Washington, D.C. I refer to them as the Brotherhood of Darkness, but they have been here. They have always been working within our society. Their ultimate goal was to use the financial and political power of the United States to bring about the world government. And the major driving force behind this effort to have a world government is right here in the United States today, where they play little games like we oppose the ICC or the International Criminal Court or we won't sign the Kyoto Protocol. But where do you think all the drive to get that came from? We were the major driving force to get the International Criminal Court, but we couldn't tell the American people. We were the major driving force behind Kyoto and the Biodiversity Treaty, but we couldn't tell the American people, so we play coy, oh, we're just not going to go along with that. for the time being. So pick up the story as we get to the 11th Amendment, David, and now, of course, all of our listeners are back with us, and
yes.
Explain to them the significance of the 11th Amendment and then what they've done to our wonderful Constitution and Bill of Rights since that time.
The 11th Amendment actually protects the states against being sued by a citizen of another state. Say I'm the state of Maryland and I have a contract with the state of Virginia. They violate the terms of that contract. Well, the 11th Amendment says I can't do that. I cannot sue them. I have no rights in court if I form a contract with another state of which I am not a citizen. Actually, this arose from a lawsuit against the state of Georgia in 1793, and people saw what took place there and decided, hey, we're going to protect the state from being sued. Is not a wise thing. When government does things that are evil, it should be accountable equally to us as citizens. We have to abide by the law. We have to abide by the contracts we make. Why shouldn't states be held to the same standard as individuals? So the 11th Amendment, in a sense, is a strike against the rights of individuals and an empowerment given to states to protect them from such action.
Even though they acted irresponsibly, even though the employees or appointees of the state had violated their oath and promises, they can't be sued, which
yeah.
really isn't fair. But then you have to understand that so many, much of what's been done since 1791 has been designed not to increase our freedom, but actually to take it away.
And that's exactly what the 11th Amendment did. It took away a chunk of our freedom. Well, it was 6 years later, the next amendment, the 12th Amendment, was ratified, and this amendment actually changes the process in the Electoral College. Up to that point in time, it was a different system in which president and vice president were elected. The person who received the majority of electors, he became the president. The person who came in second became the vice president. So two opposing candidates, say, you know, if we were to take the past election or a couple elections back, they say Gore and Bush, well, Bush won and Gore came in second, so Gore would be the vice president. And we had some interesting scenarios with the first couple of presidencies with that taking place where our arch enemies basically were having to work together in the executive. And so this was a change in that structure. From that point forward, another 61 years passed before another amendment was recognized as ratified. But during that 61 years, Dr. Stan, I just want to mention two unratified or contested articles, because one of them is very interesting. This one is often called the secret 13th Amendment, because there are those who argue that it was ratified in 1819, and it said that if any citizen of the United States shall accept, claim, or receive or retain any title of nobility or honor, or shall, without consent of the Congress, accept or retain any present pension, office, emolument, or of any kind, whatever, from any emperor, king, prince, or foreign power, such person shall cease to be a citizen of the United States and shall be incapable of holding any office of trust or profit under them or either of them. So this was designed to protect us from having a fifth column in our midst, people who were actually traitors, who had loyalty to a foreign power, a king or an emperor or what have you, serving in the government here and undermining us. And so, you know, there's an interesting discussion here, if you read various researchers, about the probable ratification of this article, and yet it was not recognized as being ratified, and you wonder why. What was the intent of those who wanted to prevent this from being recognized as ratified? Obviously, they wanted people to be able to get away with this kind of treasonous activity of being loyal to a foreign power while serving in the U.S. government.
Well, let me just point out that the whole idea has always been, of course, most people don't understand that, but this idea of a world government. And so those people who are loyalty is to the United Nations and not to our country. The people who would ratify all of these treaties that would limit the power of our own duly elected representatives and have laws then that would be superimposed upon our laws and would then be accepted rather than the constitutional laws. This whole idea, I believe, has always been a stepping stone along the way towards this idea of a world government. And believe me, we have people in the highest levels of our government today, and the people leading both of our political parties, whose loyalty is not to America, but to this globalist dream of establishing the world government. And of course, from a religious point of view, if you analyze it, if you read the Luciferian publications as I do, why, they will tell you that organization is the United Nations, mm-hmm. which are the leaders of both political parties, and with successive presidents, whether they be Republicans or Democrats, they all support the United Nations.
Yes, there's only one member of Congress that I'm aware of who is consistently opposed, and that's Ron Paul, who I understand every year submits a bill for getting the U.S. out of the U.N., and he almost has, if I remember, almost no co-sponsors. In other words, all the rest of the members of Congress are in this camp. They are disloyal to the United States, and they're not willing to stand up for what is true. Well, that's a contested article. Another unratified article was very interesting because it was proposed in 1861. It was actually endorsed by President Lincoln, and we're going to talk about why that's significant. But it said that no amendment should be made to the Constitution which shall authorize or give Congress the power to abolish or interfere within any state with the domestic institutions thereof, including that of persons held to labor or service by the laws of said state. In other words, this was an amendment that would say you can't touch the issue of slavery on the federal level. That's a state's issue. States have power to determine whether their state is going to have slavery or not have slavery. That's not the business of the federal government. And this is very clear. The interesting thing is Lincoln sided with this, and he supported this before he took power. Once he took power, we know he turned tail on that and actually began a campaign that is known as the War Between the States, or some like to call it in more accurate terms, perhaps, the War of Northern Aggression, or the Second War for Independence, a war which we lost. And in the loss of that war, there was a great loss to the independence of our nation, and that was demonstrated in the actual 13th article, 13th Amendment, the 14th Amendment, and the 15th Amendment. Each of these amendments struck at a foundation stone in the constitutional structure. First, the foundation stone of the 13th, it abolished slavery, but basically it said that you cannot have slavery in your states, which up to this point in time, including the unratified article, the point was that slavery could be legitimate, and it was constitutional, provided it was what that state determined. In other words, it was not the business of the federal government to poke its nose into the affairs of the state, including the issue of slavery. Well, 13th Amendment struck that down and basically said the federal government is going to tell you states what you can and cannot do regarding the issue of slavery.
Well, David, let me just play the devil's advocate.
Sure.
And then many people are going to say, but slavery was definitely wrong. And so weren't we justified in having the federal government say that you can't have slavery in the United States? Because certainly there were many, many people who felt very deeply at that time, both in the South and in the North, that slavery was wrong. Actually, I think probably not more than, well, certainly not more than 5% of Southerners even had slaves.
Right.
But this was accepted at the time. So isn't America a lot better off without slavery? Now, I'm playing the devil's advocate, but I want to get your response to that.
Yes, because, first of all, slavery was not as bad an institution as it's been made out to be. In other words, there were many slaves who loved their masters and willingly served them, and to abolish that, for example, take some of our founding fathers like Thomas Jefferson. He recognized that if he set his slaves free, quote-unquote, those slaves would be in a terrible situation because they wouldn't have a job, they had no property, they would suddenly be destitute, and they'd be basically homeless. So he recognized that while he abhorred the idea of slavery, he recognized that there was a situation in which it was not so easy to extract oneself without bringing great harm to the individuals who were slaves. So some of the people, I believe he set free at his death and so on, but it was not an easy situation to quickly resolve.
I think it's important to realize that there were many blacks in the North who were free men who had themselves had slaves.
Yes, yes.
And, of course, this is something that they never mentioned. And actually, slavery was on the way out. It was not
yes.
an economically sound. There were other alternatives. You did not need the type of letter. And they would have done away with slavery without the Civil War.
Had they been let to do it, yes.
But they weren't to be allowed to do that. Because they wanted the crisis situation. They wanted the Civil War. They wanted the barbarity. but mostly they wanted to change our Constitution. So at times there have been efforts in the past to actually say, well, 10 years from now slavery will end, and that was effectively blocked by the people who, of course, wanted a crisis. Why? Because out of the crisis would come the changes of our Constitution, which today we feel as we see little by little the freedom of what was once a free land for both black and white being progressively eroded. We'll be back in just a moment with Pastor David Whitney. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Pastor David Whitney of the Institute of the Constitution. You pick up the story there, David.
Well, the other aspect of the 13th Amendment that's very important, this was a first time that this phrase had been used. Section 2 of Amendment 13 says, Congress shall have power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. This same phrase is used again and again in the 14th and the 15th and in numerous other amendments. But basically, it gave a blank check to Congress to do whatever it deemed necessary to enforce this. So it extremely expanded the power of the federal government. And if your listeners have done any reading about the terrible time in the history of our nation following the war between the states called Reconstruction and the enormous abuses by the federal government of those states that were now subjugated states, basically states that as a whole were being stripped of their economic power and destroyed from one end to the other. I mean, Reconstruction was almost worse than the war itself and the kind of damage it did to those southern states. And that power was granted to Congress. Congress, you can do whatever you want. Our founding fathers would never, ever have countenanced such a statement. After all, it was Thomas Jefferson said, don't trust men with power, but chain them down, bind them down with the chains of the Constitution. He recognized that even as clearly as they, the Founding Fathers, had constructed walls to protect citizens against an overreaching and tyrannical government, that unless those terms of the Constitution were enforced by we the people, that the government would continue to expand its power bit by bit and we would lose our freedoms. The price of freedom, as it's been said, is eternal vigilance. And this is where we as citizens of these United States have fallen down on the job. If we lose our freedoms, which they are being lost rapidly, it is because we have failed to understand the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and understand the subsequent changes to those that have stripped us progressively of our freedom. And we have not taken up the mantle that is part of our duty in this covenant of a government that we have to hold our elected officials accountable, throw the bums out who will not follow the Constitution, and only vote, only put people into office who will follow the Constitution.
Now, David, I've heard that one of the major reasons for the Civil War was really not slavery. This wasn't the reason that the Northerners wanted it, but it had to do with economics. Northern states were industrialized, and they wanted high tariffs so that the people in the South would have to buy their goods rather than being able to get cheaper goods from other countries. And so the Southerners felt this was downright, you know, unfair, and of course they were required then to sell their cotton to the Northern states at very low rates, sort of almost cartel-like arrangements. So everything was being used to use the power of government to impoverish the South and, of course, enrich the North. And the Southern states were very bitter against this, weren't they?
That's right, and that's exactly the economic reasons. An excellent book is The Real Lincoln by Professor Tom DiLorenzo that spells out many of those economic reasons, and also that the plan of Lincoln, when he was way back as a congressman and so forth, the plan of Lincoln was involved in what is called mercantilism. That is a kind of monopoly between big business and government, where government gives subsidies to big business, then big business fills the pockets and the coffers of politicians who get the legislation passed that's going to favor big business. And this kind of monopoly between big business and government was what Lincoln was all about. He was about giving millions of dollars of federal taxpayers' money to railroads. That was his favorite thing.
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening, of course, is Pastor David Whitney. And, of course, Pastor Whitney was saying that prior to the Civil War, there was a great deal of unrest, especially in the South, but in many parts of the country, because there seemed to be a very close working relationship between some of the people working in the legislature and working at the highest levels of government and big corporations, and they were taking the money that was taken from the taxes that were provided to the federal government by the states, because they didn't have an income tax at that time, but then the tariffs and the customs taxes and all these things, and they were giving it to specific favored groups. In other words, they were giving money to corporations and businesses that had close business ties to people in government. Well, you know, that was, what, 150 or more years ago. Yeah. And nothing's changed. It's exactly what's going on today. I mean, we see Halliburton over there getting all these favored no-bid contracts over in Iraq, and you know, hundreds of millions of dollars disappearing. And of course, everybody remembers that Dick Cheney was the president of Halliburton before he became vice president. He even got a deferred salary after he became vice president. I don't quite understand that. So it sounds like not very much has changed in the last 150 years or so.
That's right. Instead, those who were fighting the Lincoln kind of mercantilism, it appears that by and large have lost the battle. And today, big government and big business are in the same bed together. And, you know, the politicians cry, oh, big business is evil. But that's only a show they put on out front. In reality, they're taking piles of money from big business in order to do whatever big business needs them to do to secure their business. So the 13th Amendment, Dr. Stan, was just a terrible, devastating blow to the design of our founding fathers in the Constitution. They add insult to injury. The 14th Amendment was even worse than the 13th Amendment in the blow that it inflicted upon the states. Very interesting to note about what took place in the ratification debates of the 14th Amendment and the disagreements that took place. You know, the 13th Amendment was ratified by sufficient number of states to be legitimately placed into the law of the land. But the 14th Amendment to the state was rejected by all of the southern states. They sent it to the southern states. All of the southern states voted it down. And what was discussed on the floor of the House was Senator Doolittle from Wisconsin said this: "The people of the South have rejected the constitutional amendment," referring to the 14th, "and therefore we will march upon them and force them to adopt it at the point of the bayonet."
Well, now, why did the South object to the 14th Amendment? What was there in the 14th Amendment that was so different than the 13th Amendment?
The 14th Amendment said all persons born or naturalized in the United States, subject to its jurisdiction, are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. The 14th Amendment stripped the states of the ability to determine who is a citizen. For example, here in Maryland, and by the way, Maryland didn't ratify the 14th Amendment up until 1959. One of those few states that held out and said, no, we're not ratifying that piece of garbage. But anyway, it stripped the states of having an individual standard as to who became a citizen. For example, in Maryland here, all the way up until the 20th century, you could not become a citizen of the state unless you subscribe to a basic Christian doctrine of belief that the Trinity and the Bible and that Jesus Christ is the Savior of the world and so on, that you had to say that this is what you believed in order to become a citizen. So an atheist could not be a citizen, and that was a set of regulations established by the state of Maryland, not by the federal government. Well, the federal government is now saying, states, you cannot determine who are your citizens and who are not your citizens. We, the federal government, are going to tell you who your citizens are. And then those citizens, it went on to say that no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States.
And so I think that it's so vitally important that people really understand that this was an abridgment of states' rights, and once you begin to limit what the states can do and increase the power of the central government, this is a stepping stone towards tyranny. And I think that's probably what they were much more upset about, much more so than slavery, wasn't it?
That's right. And, you know, the fact that Doolittle was saying, at the point of the bayonet, and we will establish military power over them until they do adopt it, is exactly what happened. Those states in the South were forced to adopt the 14th Amendment at the point of a bayonet. But that of course is not what our founding fathers ever intended to take place.
But, of course, they never expected the 14th Amendment to be linked up with the First Amendment completely change the relationship between the federal government and religion and actually create the situation where we have today, where the federal government can say, you know, well, since the 14th Amendment extends the power of the federal government, and the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law, then we will say not only the Congress, but the states will be able to make no law respecting an established religion. That's why we can't mention God or have prayer or the Ten Commandments in our schools, or certainly not the Declaration of Independence. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I guess this evening is David Whitney. Let's go. We have, hope we don't lose you here. David, I'm going to go to and get Bill. Bill, did you have a question at all on the 14th Amendment?
I had a question for your guest about how he would feel or how he feels about what, say, the southern states were doing during, say, the time of Jim Crow laws and lynchings and not allowing votes to blacks to vote and things like that in the South, and if that should have just been tolerated because that's what the states, say, of Alabama and Mississippi and Louisiana wanted to, or that the federal government was right to go in to ensure those people that they were treated like human beings.
Could I ask you a question, Bill?
What?
Could I ask you a question, and perhaps and then David to get that to answer? Let's imagine that the federal government becomes totally tyrannical and wants, for instance, to control what's taught in our schools. What do you do? How do you fight that? Because there's no way you can change what's going on in Washington, D.C. really very effectively. Under the state, if there were injustice in your state, you could do one of two things. You could either fight it or you could pick up and leave. What do you do when you have a tyranny in the central government?
That's the, you know, there's no such thing as a perfect system. You have to go through your representative. You have to talk with them. They have to take it to the table in D.C., and they have to pound it out. Democracy is slow and complicated.
Do you believe we're a democracy?
Pardon me?
Are we a democracy?
As close as you can get. We're a representative government.
We are not a democracy. We're a republic. We are a government of laws. Then you don't believe the idea of limiting the power of the central government. You believe whatever the central government wants to do is perfectly all right?
No. I don't believe that. I believe it's a balance.
How do you balance it? Because men are basically corrupt and evil, and our founding fathers realized you could never trust men with power.
Right, that's why we have three divisions of government.
More than those three divisions of government, though, Bill, we have levels of government, the federal, state, county, and local.
Right,
and that design has been lost by the what took place with the 13th and 14th Amendment, because there were certain powers given to the state governments that were being violated by the federal government. Yes. You might not like the Jim Crow laws, but you know what contributed most to the Jim Crow laws? It was Reconstruction. Blacks and whites got along far better in the South during the era of slavery than they did Reconstruction and following. Did you know that you read the stories about what took place in the North? There was far more racism in the North prior to the war between the states than there was in the South. Blacks and whites got along very well in the South. And after Reconstruction, which violated the rights of the whites and manipulated and abused and used the blacks for the wrong reason, then there was the animosity built up, and the people were looking to reconstruct.
All right, fine. Dave, are you there?
Tony, I'll ask you to get our guest back on the... Line 6, if you wouldn't mind.
And let's go to line 3, but please go to our guest back on line 6, please. That's okay. We've got Roger calling right now, and we'll get David Whitney back again. I don't know what happened, but what the point that Bill was making, and I didn't cut Bill off. We suddenly got something here happened to the board. But the point is, Bill is making, look, there's injustice. The federal government's got to step in. Well, let me point out that a recent poll showed that 96% of the American people do not want to make the people who are in this country here illegally illegal. But it doesn't really matter what the people want. It doesn't matter even what our elected representatives want, because they were going to be forced to go along with the programs they're going to be put in by an all-powerful central government. Yes, there are problems in any free society, and you've really got to get in and you've got to work and to try to keep them, from the... you have to try within the state to try to remedy that, and in many states it actually had laws that actually did away with a lot of the injustice. And there was injustice in the South, but let me tell you one thing, and I saw this very definitely. Many of the great corporations had programs of discrimination. Many of the great, and I'm speaking specifically of Standard Oil and of Chevron Oil and similar corporations. They were the very people who, on one hand, were doing everything they could to discriminate. For instance, if you were black, you could not have a Chevron station or a Standard Oil station. They were the very ones who were pushing for all-powerful federal government. They created the problem on one hand, and of course they then had a solution, which was the progressive loss of freedom. And the same thing was true with the Ku Klux Klan. The Ku Klux Klan was organized originally as a branch of Masonry, and the purpose of Masonry has always been to centralize all power with Washington, D.C. And, of course, the Ku Klux, the Masonry, talk about discrimination. You cannot, at least up until very, very recent times, and only with very few lodges, have any black man in a Masonic lodge. They have their own separate lodges, but they are not allowed to join an all-white lodge, at least not until very, very recently. Why? Well, they create the problem on one hand, and their solution is always more government control. The easiest way that we don't have to be worried about what goes on is to have a dictatorship. But is that really what we want to do? If we have laws, we should abide by them. If you want to change the Constitution, you change the Constitution. But you don't allow the federal government to go in and do that unilaterally. Let's go ahead. We've got David back, and I'll ask our producer, always put the guest on line 6, please, Tony. Don't put him on line 1, because we have real problems like we did. Okay, go ahead, David. What is your answer, Bill? Because I think Bill's question is a very legitimate one. Isn't the easiest thing just to send the troops into the South and force the South to do away with the Jim Crow laws, to force the South to integrate their schools?
Yes, that's what we did, but it obviously makes the point that the federal government wanted to make. You do not have any powers as a state. And once you run over the state and you tell the state it has no power, what's next? Gay rights? Okay. You as the state have to have hate crimes law. You as the state have to have these special rights for gay people. You as the state have to have gay marriage. All of those things, once they're centralized in the federal government can run over the states, and the states basically have no powers, which is almost the situation we're in today, that the state is a minor subdivision of the federal government, completely opposite of what our founding fathers want. They wanted strong states and a weak central government. Instead, today we have a mega mammoth leviathan central government and very weak states, and the result of that is we as individual citizens do not have our God-given rights protected. Consider the Fourth Amendment. It says no unreasonable search and seizure. The federal government declares the Patriot Act, and now we have unreasonable search and seizure on every American in the United States, and their own state cannot defend them against the federal government, which was the design, that the federal government would be checked by the power of the states and prevented from becoming a tyrant. And we have lost that, and the war between the states and the ratification of 13th, 14th, and 15th was a major issue in doing that.
But you see, what happens is not only has the black lost their freedom, but the white has lost their freedom.
Everyone.
So the white and black have both lost. What has happened in America is that today over one-third of all young black men are either in prison, on probation, or parole. Is that what you really want for the black people? And, of course, they are being put into federal prisons where they're being used for virtual slave labor there. The largest employer in this country is the prison system, and those prisoners are working and turking out things at wages which are very, very similar to that are paid in communist China today. Is that really what you want? Because, you see, once you've allowed this whole centralization of power, why, of course, they can target specific races, and they have targeted the black race in this country.
That's right.
Is it simply by accident that the incidence of AIDS is 20 times more frequent in black women than in white women? 20 times more frequent in black women than white women. How did that happen? Well, I don't think it happened by accident. Over half of the black people in this country believe that AIDS was created by our government to target them. And you know something? I think they're absolutely right. But where's the outcry from the bleeding heart liberals? Oh, no, my goodness. We've got to have more power in the federal government to solve the problems at the local level. Government, by its very essence, is evil. That's what Thomas Paine said. All societies are good, but government, even at its best, is a necessary evil. Government can solve all of our problems, just as it did in Adolf Hitler's Germany, as it did in Benito Mussolini's Italy. But, of course, if we want to be free, why, we've got to limit the power of the federal government. Go ahead.
And talking about the 14th Amendment, you mentioned a very important point that I think it's important for your listeners to understand, that the intent of the 14th Amendment is not how the 14th Amendment is being used today. It's called the Incorporation Doctrine. It's the belief today by those in judicial power that the 14th Amendment incorporated the entire Bill of Rights, 1 through 10, upon the states. And they get this from the phrase in the 14th Amendment that is actually derived directly from the 5th Amendment, that no state shall deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, and or deny any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. That's a phrase taken right out of the 5th Amendment, only part of the 5th Amendment. And the argument is, well, because they took a piece out of the 5th Amendment, and here they say this is forced upon the states, no state shall deprive any person, then the entire Bill of Rights from 1 through 10 also are pushed upon the states and forced upon the states. We know that that is a lie. That is not historic fact. And the reason we know that is just a few years later, the 14th Amendment ratified in 1866, just within 10 years, another amendment was proposed that never passed. It was not ratified. There was not a sufficient number of congressmen, senators to even push it on to the states. It was called the Blaine Amendment, after a senator up in Maine. And this Blaine Amendment, it would have required the First Amendment to be forced upon the states. Just as this phrase out of the Fifth Amendment has been part of the 14th Amendment, it would have said the First Amendment and all of its things, it's no longer Congress, it was no state can establish a religion, no state can do anything like what the First Amendment says. So that failed. So the same people that were ratifying the 14th Amendment turned down the Blaine Amendment. They refused, they rejected it because, no, they said the First Amendment does not apply to the states. It says Congress shall not make any law respecting the establishment of religion. They knew the intent of our founding fathers was that states were free to have established religions. 9 of the 13 states had established religions at the time of the First Amendment that was being debated and ratified. So that false doctrine, that incorporation doctrine, is exactly what you spoke of earlier, why the First Amendment now is applied to the states, and then not just to the states, it's applied to the county, it's applied to the school board, and then they say, oh, that means the local school cannot have any religious teaching whatsoever, they can't have the Bible, you can't have the Ten Commandments on the wall, you can't pray, because of this false incorporation doctrine saying the First Amendment applies to the states. It did not at the time of the ratification of the First Amendment, and it did not at the time of the ratification of the 14th Amendment. It was in no way intended by those who ratified the 14th Amendment to incorporate the entire Bill of Rights for each of the states. But the evildoers, they have been hard at work, and the evildoers know that most Americans have not studied the history behind this. They have not studied the Constitution nor the Bill of Rights, and therefore they can be duped. They can be duped with phrases like a wall of separation between church and state. They can be duped with this false incorporation doctrine because they don't know the facts. And therefore, if you don't know the truth, your liberties are going to be taken from you. As Thomas Jefferson said, anybody who wants to be ignorant and free desires what never was and never will be. People have to study the Constitution to maintain their freedom.
Well, let's go to Roger, who's calling in from Pennsylvania. Roger, are you there?
Yes, thanks, Jeff. Yeah, would you care to explicate any further? And then I had a not tightly related question. That is on the so-called missing 13th, supposedly.
Well, we've really already covered that.
Well, supposedly it was.
It was ratified, but there were people who did not want that, so they said it wasn't ratified. So because they did not want this limitation put on the ability to people to have other loyalties other than to our own country.
And then as to the having a foreign My question was, the British accredited registry, the bar, would qualify to disqualify someone having standing there from being an office holder.
And that, for our listeners, of course, what Roger is saying is that many people feel that all of our lawyers somehow get their authority from the British bar. Is there any, how do you feel about that, David?
That is a possible argument, but I've discussed and I've asked a number of attorneys who are friends about that same issue, and they say in accepting the bar, they were in no way, unless there's some hidden contract, there is no way in which they were acknowledging the British sovereignty of the Crown Temple or the Inn. You know, they don't have any connection with that, and they have stated that, that there was no secret thing that took place in them being approved that would involve that kind of foreign allegiance. And so I take their word at it. I know them, and I trust they're honest people, so I believe that there is an idea afoot that every lawyer, therefore, has violated that contested 13th Amendment. And I don't think that is accurate, from my understanding.
Roger, why don't you research on that and then come back and let us know, okay?
I'd like to know more about it.
Okay, we're going to have to go now. I hope we don't lose. Let's go to Ari here. Hi, Ari, how are you doing?
Yeah, fine, thanks. I would disagree about the 13th Amendment. I think I would support anything that made slavery abolished, because after all, the Declaration of Independence says that all men are created equal, and aren't black people men?
Yes, and they are.
You're absolutely right, but it also, the idea of our form of government is that sovereign states, 13 sovereign nations is maybe the best way to understand it. People here in Maryland referred to my nation as the state of Maryland well up into the beginning of the 19th century. You need to understand 13
sovereign nations. Yeah, I understand the issue about... Can I jump in for a second?
Go ahead.
I understand the issue about states' rights, but I think what... All I'm asking for is... The first 10 amendments are also restrictions on states' rights because, you know, there are certain things the states cannot do. They cannot deprive a person of fundamental freedoms of association, press, religion, and so forth. Slavery should be elevated to the status of one of those.
No, wait a minute. Let me just ask Ari, because Ari's a friend.
Mm-hmm.
Ari, what does the First Amendment said?
Congress shall make no law.
No, it was a restriction on Congress, not
right.
on the states.
Okay, that's right. I didn't phrase that correctly.
And I know how you feel about it, and certainly we are all against
slavery. The state is not entitled to deprive someone of the rights that they have under a person has under the Constitution. Isn't that right?
Well, the thing
is, cannot deprive someone of due process, for example, because the Constitution guarantees that a citizen cannot be denied due process.
No,
is that correct?
The Constitution just guarantees that each state will have a republican form of government, Article 4, Section 4. That's what it guarantees.
In other words, this was all to be taken care of at the states, and as imperfect as that was, I mean, that was the way that it was set up. Now, we certainly would all agree that slavery was wrong, and, you know, and certainly the 13th Amendment did away with slavery, and the southern states voted in favor of that,
mm-hmm.
because there was a tremendous drive at that time to do away with slavery. They didn't need the Civil War. It was just that there are certain people who wanted that Civil War. But then you get to the 14th and 15th Amendment, which were to really change the whole relationship between the states and the federal government, and that was where the real difference of opinion came in. Would that be a fair statement, David?
Yes, because once you begin to chip away at the powers, by the way, your guest or your caller used states' rights. I don't like the term states' rights. Rights only exist for individuals. Rights are given to us by God. States have powers, and governments have powers that we, the people, through our covenant, our Constitution, grant to them certain limited delegated powers, and that's the whole argument here. There was limited powers set on the federal government, and they began, by these amendments, began to break down the wall that kept those powers limited. So that why do we have an unlimited tyrannical government in Washington, D.C. today that tells you how much water you can flush down your toilet? How did we get to that place? We got to that place by destroying the major check upon the federal government's power, and that is the powers granted to the states by the 10th Amendment.
All right, let's get Ari. Go ahead, Ari.
I'm just asking, I mean, does the state have the power to jail a person for being a Christian or for speaking freely or for associating with people they want and so forth? Does the state have that power?
Originally they did. In fact, this was one of the problems, the injustices that they had, and even after the Constitution was established, they had state religions, and sometimes they one Christian sect would outlaw another Christian sect and force them out of that area. But they worked that out at the state level, and
right.
It was basically, as people saw the injustice that existed under that system, then the people at the state would try to solve it, and most of our problems we did solve. Here in the state of California, there was discrimination against blacks, and eventually they passed legislation in Sacramento that said you couldn't discriminate against blacks, you couldn't refuse to allow them to eat in an institution. Because, believe me, at one time there was discrimination here, but that was outlawed by state law.
It just doesn't make sense that if theoretically, if every state made it a crime to possess a firearm, then they could do that, and then the Second Amendment would become completely meaningless.
That's what they're doing
so
today.
To me, I don't understand how there could be that contradiction take place. How could that be permitted in this country?
What you need to understand is that it's far easier to change your state government, to change your state constitution, to alter what's going on that local level than it is on the federal level. We have far less influence on what our senators down in Washington D.C. or our congressmen down in Washington D.C. are going to do, but we have far greater influence over our state delegates and state senators to change when we see injustice in our land.
That was the whole idea, Eric. It would take care of the states. The power of the federal government was to be limited and ill-defined. Point 45 of the 45th of the Federalist Papers. The power of the state government was unlimited and ill-defined. We'll be back.
I'll read up on that.
Hold on here for just a minute. Okay, Eric, go ahead.
Okay, it's hard for me to believe that the Founding Fathers would have constructed a system that gave the states the power to deny what the Constitution was intended to guarantee.
No, really, the Constitution was not intended to guarantee.
Right.
The Constitution was simply an alignment of the states so that we would have a federal government that could protect this country, but matters dealing with life and liberty and property were to be managed at the state level. As unjust as that may seem, that was the way it was set up, and it was the finest system that we've ever known. Get the Federalist Papers. We carry the Federalist Papers, and read the 45th of the Federalist Papers, and it's very clear what they intended, because they feared if you ever gave power to the federal government to do good, it would do evil.
I will read that. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you so much, Eric. And I realize, of course, when people have never been educated in these things,
mm-hmm.
It took me an awful long time to begin to have enough knowledge to understand what the Founding Fathers really meant. And you've got to go and you've got to read the Federalist Papers and understand what Madison said in the 10th Federalist Papers about the fact that we do never want to have a democracy in America. And as he said, democracies are air spectacles of turbulence and contention are incompatible with the rights of personal security and liberty, and are usually as violent and as short in their lives as they are violent in their deaths. But as far as the separation of power, the federal government was to have no power to solve the problems of society.
That I would totally agree with. Okay.
Anything else, David, now? Go ahead.
Well, the system we're under now is the opposite, and look at the terrible injustices and evil that's being done by our federal government. What defense do we have now that the states have been stripped of their powers as designed by our Founding Fathers? We, the citizens, have no defense against the tyrannical federal government that runs over our rights every single day of the week and gets away with it, and we don't have any way to defend ourselves against them.
And that is the real problem today. We can't do anything about pornography, obscenity, or any of the things. We're moving into a position of moral anarchy. And out of moral anarchy will come the call for a dictatorship. And, of course, we're seeing what's happening with our financial system. Our country's going bankrupt. And where do you solve? Who do you turn to when you have just total lawlessness? Why, you have to have a dictator. And that was the whole idea, and that's why William Penn had said those will not be ruled by God, will be ruled by tyrants. And the only way you can have a stable society is to have moral people, and if you don't have moral people, you're going to have moral anarchy, and Well, that, Ari, do you have anything else to say before we let you go?
No, thanks. That's it.
God bless you. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a minute and let David get his telephone number out. Well, we're not going to be able to take a call from Doug from Montana because the hour is over. Although he's welcome to call in next hour during Joel Skousen. But let's get your telephone number and your website out.
Yes, our toll-free number is 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or website is iotconline.com. And they can order an Institute on the Constitution where they can teach what the Founding Fathers' vision was for our country, very simply because Dr. Eisenow does all the work, just put in the videos and walk your students through the notebook in an excellent way to give a working knowledge of the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and the Declaration of Independence.
Thank you so much for being with us, David.
We'll look forward to having you
on again next month.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time, and I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and if you're out there listening to us across America and you agree with us, we hope many of you will decide you're going to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters. Now, I do need to mention that our telephone number, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Our evening shortwave frequency, and if you're listening on shortwave, you don't need to know what it is. If you're not listening, you're not going to hear what I have to say, but they've changed our shortwave frequency again. Our afternoon, instead of being 7.535, is now 7.520. That's 7.520. Our evening is 7.580. And, of course, the other frequency in the evening, 5.835, has not changed. So that will clarify it. I hope that you'll have encourage others to listen. I hope we can pick up the listening audience we lost last time. They did this without giving us even a day's notice, suddenly changing our frequency literally the same day. Now, the other thing I want to mention is that we are still offering the case of Brotherhood of Darkness. Any of you would be interested in having a full case of the books, we're doing a massive printing, and of course by doing that, why, we can make a very, very special offer. So if you'd like to get a case of Brotherhood of Darkness, I'll know more about that. There's 62 books in a case. Why don't you call us at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And we do hope that you'll give serious consideration to that, because by reading the Brotherhood of Darkness, you begin to understand the very nature of the enemy that we face today. There is organized evil in America. People work through secret societies. Many of these people have sold their souls to the devil. Now, if you doubt that this sort of thing really goes on, you really need to see a video we carry called They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll, the 3-hour, the 4-hour, the 10-hour version. And if you have any question about Michael Jackson and why he is in the trouble he is today, you need to see They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll, because it goes into Michael Jackson and many of the other very popular stars of today. This will change the entire way you look at music. It may change the way you look at the world. They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll, certainly our new video that I go into the background of how they're poisoning our children. It's called, none dare call it genocide, and we go into the Vioxx, Celebrex situation. We go into how they're using fluoride and aspartame and mercury to poison the minds of our children, which is why our children, so many of them, when they get through high school, they can't compete. Why we have so few people going into the sciences and engineering today, because our kids can no longer think as effectively as they did in generations past. This is not happening by accident. It's happening by intent. Or as Bertrand Russell said, by diet, injections, and injunctions. We will mold the character of the youth. Again, the telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. If you haven't seen Megiddo 1, or Megiddo 2. We recommend that. Bill Sardi's great video on the talk that he gave at the conference, we certainly recommend to you as well. And that is available by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Please remember our website at RadioLiberty.com, and then pray for America. Pray for revival, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And we have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But, well, I was going to say we ask you to hold your calls, but the reason I was sort of chuckling here is because suddenly we find our guest, who is scheduled for this hour, Joel Skousen, is not going to be here. He has laryngitis. He can't appear, and so it's going to be just you and me, and so I'm going to have to actually encourage you to give us a call, and if you're out there and in the listening audience and you have a question or comment on what we're talking about or any subject you would like, we're going to have open lines here, because, first of all, I have nothing prepared at all. And secondly, let's just sort of talk a little bit about some of the things that I think really are so vitally important to analyze, to understand what's going on in the world today. I was doing my newsletter, which would be the February newsletter, and as we began looking at the background of the wars of this past century, of course it really started with the Spanish-American War. And you begin, as you analyze the wars, to find that each war is created with an incident. You have to get the American people to be willing to go to war, because it is not normal that people would want to kill other people. So how do you get men to fight well and die? Well, you have to have an enemy, and you have to have an enemy that is ruthless and tyrannical, and so you have to have atrocity stories, and you have to play those atrocity stories over and over again to condition the minds of the American people to believe certain specific things that probably, in large part, just are not true. Now, again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And give us a call if you have a question. We'd love to talk to you. But I will just go into the background of the Spanish-American War. You have to understand that there were people in the United States who wanted a war at that time. J.P. Morgan, the Rockefeller interest, Andrew Carnegie, William Randolph Hearst, the people who owned the Pulitzer Papers. There was a ruling elite in America that wanted to expand the American empire. They believed in this idea of dominance, America dominating the world. And many of these people were tied into this original secret society. Now, admittedly, we're, 8 or 10 generations down the line, but that's all right. These evil and wicked people have always been in this country. There were comparable people over in Great Britain at the time who wanted, of course, to expand the British Empire with the idea that Great Britain would rule the world. And they tied into the Cecil Rhodes Group. Cecil Rhodes created a secret society in 1891, which he, or Lord Milner, Lord Esher, Lord Stead, William Stead, were the members. And this is all covered in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. But we actually have copies of the William Stead's diary, where he tells how they formed the secret society. So these people wanted to create, of course, a war in Africa, with the whole idea of the war in Africa. They wanted to consolidate the African continent under British rule, and own a whole string of colonies from Cape Town to Cairo. And they wanted to put a railway in there, and then they would use that as a means of dominating the east coast of Africa and then all of Africa, and then they would move from there to consolidating the world. Now, we're going to go to Will, who's calling from Missouri, but before I go to him, let me suggest that any of you who doubt what I'm saying either need to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, or if you'd like to read Cecil Rhodes' Confession of Faith. Why, we have that. We found it. It's very hard to get. But in about 1875, Cecil Rhodes wrote a Confession of Faith. We outlined this plan that where there would be this control of the world. And he wrote there, "The idea dancing and gleaming before one's eyes is this: why should we not create a secret society to bring all the underdeveloped countries of the world under British rule?" Now, if you'd like to, of course, get a free copy of that, we'd be glad to send it to you. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. We'll send you a free copy of Cecil Rhodes' Confession of Faith, and you can read it and understand that, this was the beginning of this whole drive towards world government, but this is a continuation of the plans of the mystery religions of antiquity, because, of course, Cecil Rhodes and Lord Milner and William Stead were all involved in the occult. I don't know about Lord Escher. He probably was, but I haven't been able to document that. Well, let's go to Will, who's calling from Missouri. Hi, Will. How are you doing?
Very good, Dr. Stan. Thank you for taking my call. And I wanted to call in early so that we could tie back to Ari's comment and question in the last hour in regards to the Constitution.
And, of course, Ari's question was very good, and so was Bill's question for that matter, because it doesn't seem to be fair that the federal government can't step in to remedy the injustice.
That's right. But I think that we need to remember, first of all, whenever we're thinking about history, we have to go back and put ourselves in history and not trying to paint history with today's point of view and the things that have come across in our life. But at the time that the Constitution was being drafted, Adam Smith, writing in his Wealth of Nations, has a whole section where he very eloquently and painfully puts out the idea that it is far easier, it would have been far easier for Great Britain to let go of its very expensive to protect and very expensive to maintain colonies, to give them the liberty so that they could be responsible for their own care. And in regards to the slaves, the same argument can be made. It would be much to the North, to their advantage, to give the semblance of freedom to any slave and put the care of themselves, their own education, their own clothing, their own housing, their own heating, their own food on their backs and take it off the mercantiles. And so that's part of the question that we need to carefully understand, is that there's a semblance of freedom, but freedom is not always apparent.
Well, I think the point is well made. I think that what we have to understand is that slavery was going to disappear anyway. It was there was tremendous opposition to it. The Underground Railway was smuggling slaves into the North, and people were winning their... But I think that the biggest thing that really people have to understand is the intent of our Founding Fathers, and that was that the federal government was never to solve the social issues of our time. Our guest this right now is Will, who's calling from, I guess, Missouri. And, of course, we're talking about why wasn't it the purpose or the function of the federal government to solve the problems of our society. You have an injustice, you have Jim Crow laws, you have discrimination, you have corrupt sheriffs. Why shouldn't the federal government be able to come in and take care of those things? Well, our Founding Fathers said that, you know, if you expand the power of the federal government, it will be used for evil. And so they wanted all these matters dealing with life, liberty, and property to be left up to the states, never to be solved by the federal government. Certainly, you can have corruption in voting. You've had corruption in voting in Chicago ever since I can remember. And yet, of course, the federal government's never gone in and solved that. Why? Because they want that sort of thing. And elsewhere where they have corruption in voting, like they had in Ohio this last time, when the presidential election were in one precinct, there were 800 registered voters, and of course there were 4,000 votes for George Bush. And the explanation was, well, the voting machine had a hiccup. Well, the federal government, once they can interfere, they'll interfere in the elections they want to interfere in and ignore the other elections. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And we've abandoned the concepts of the Constitution that limited the power of the central government in the name of, wouldn't it be expedient if? Isn't it better off if? And certainly, no, we've got to solve our problems at the state and local level. Because once it becomes the function of the federal government to solve all of our problems, all freedom will be lost. Go ahead, Mike.
I also believe that we need to be very careful when we go back to the Founding Fathers not to paint them up as Thomas Jefferson did, and he wasn't even present, but he called them demigods. And the people that actually drafted the founders in that room in the Philadelphia Hall These were exceedingly high up, level up aristocracy. These are lawyers. These are bankers. These are merchants. There were none of the commoners, so to speak, present. And what they were definitely doing is they were looking at getting rid of the Articles of Confederation, which was really where you would find more of the state rights issues. And they were building a government upon which they could go out and work with the world and get into commerce treaties and get back on a playing field in a world market. And so they needed to present the most powerful government on paper that they could, not only for the French and the British, but also for the Asian market as well.
But I really would disagree with you there. Well, I think that what they did, although many of these, there were people there who would really like to have had an all-powerful aristocracy. There were people like, for instance, Alexander Hamilton, who had very close ties to the Brotherhood of Darkness and to the English financial interests. He wanted to have a president who was elected for life. And he wanted an all-power, almost like a monarchy like they had in Great Britain. I think that this was the first time in all history where anybody has put together a government with limited power, where the whole idea of the central government was to limit its authority. Certainly it could deal with other countries, but it would have no power over the individual. That was the genius of our Constitution and why people throughout the world looked at our Constitution as the greatest document ever conceived by men, because it limited the power of government so people could be free. Yes, you'd have to work at your state and your local level to solve your problems. And where we got into the problems is everybody sits back and waits for somebody else to do it. But the unique part of our government was that the centralized power was limited. And, of course, you had to have a certain amount of power, but the at least possible amount of power compatible with individual freedom. And at least as much as any society in all recorded history, our system really worked very well for a time, because it had checks and balances, not only as we teach our kids in school, between the executive, judicial, and legislative, but between the states and the federal government. They never mention that today. And the whole idea was that states would provide the financing for the federal government. They would have no money other than their tariffs and customs. They were dependent upon the states for money. And not only that, but the senators represent the states, not the people. And we've forgotten that completely.
Yes,
anything else you want to say?
Well, I'll just close on one side note. Alexander Hamilton was one of the longest speeches. He spoke for over 5 hours, and they only had one vote in support of his plan, and it was his own vote.
Okay, let's go to Bart. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
And of course, Alexander Hamilton established the first central bank of the United States. He talked George Washington into that over the objection of Madison and Jefferson, who realized, of course, that the purpose of the central bank was to bring us back into the control of Great Britain. And lo and behold, when Alexander Hamilton sold the stock for this new central bank he was creating, who ended up with about a third of the stock was, of course, the British Central Bank, the powerful banking houses in England. And, of course, they had a charter for 20 years. And, of course, the charter began in 1891. It ended in 1811. And Congress refused to renew that charter. And you know what happened in 1812? America was at war. Let's go to Bart. Hi, Bart. How are you doing?
Hello, Dr. Stan. Thank you. I'm doing fine. How are you tonight,
John? I'm doing fine, except I don't have a guest, and so I'm glad you called in. And let me put out our telephone number again. It's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. That's 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. But what would you like to talk about?
It's always a wonderful history lesson listening to you on your program. I'm astounded at how you're able to maintain that quantity of knowledge in your mind. It really is a wonderful thing. One way I describe in brief to people the situation that we're dealing with nowadays is that it's a short, brief explanation that hits home pretty strongly, which is that the majority of human history in this world has been one of slavery or servitude of one degree or another, and for the first time in human history, our American system took the chains off the people and put them on the government where they belong, and now we see them coming off of the government, going back on the people, and that's how I explain it. The comment I wish to make regarded your opening statement about how the public needs an enemy in order to justify in their minds the aggression of war. And the incident that popped into my mind that mostly clearly represents that in recent times would be the Nye-Era incident just prior to the start of the first Gulf War, which I know you're familiar with, but for the listeners who are not familiar with it, just prior to the start of the first Gulf War, a young lady named Nye-Era was invited to speak before Congress, and she stated that she had been in an Iraqi hospital watching Iraqi soldiers throw live babies out of incubators so that the soldiers could steal those incubators to take them elsewhere. And it turns out that Nye-Era had not been in Iraq for, I believe it was 4 or 5 years, because she was the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador living here in the United States. The entire incident was made up of whole cloth, a lie, right in the face of Americans. And it just strikes me, Stan, that it is, Americans have become so easy to manipulate that it is frightening.
You're absolutely right. In fact, I remember that area very, very well. And I remember, of course, suddenly we sort of have this Saddam Hussein invading Kuwait, and there's talk America's going to have to do something about 5 days after the invasion. And, you know, of course, when these stories were beginning to come out about the atrocities, the Iraqi soldiers' atrocities, and I was up in at the airport, I remember, and I looked there in one of the bookstores waiting before my plane, and there's a book all about the Iraq and about the terrible situation, about the Iraqi atrocities, and I'm reading this book, and I said, how did they get this book out? I mean, we're only 5 or 6 or maybe 10 days at the most since the invasion, and they've got all these stories, and that very story you told is there, and how did they possibly get these books out that quickly? It's almost as if they'd been printed ahead of time. And I suddenly come to the conclusion they probably were printed ahead of time. Everything is scripted. And they manipulate the American people. I mean, you go back to the first Spanish-American War. It was supposedly the sinking of the Maine. But it was all scripted ahead of time. We lost, I think there were 2 officers and 158 men went down with the Maine, but the American people were told it was a Spanish mine that had blown up the battleship Maine in the Havana Harbor. And of course, after the war, and of course later on when Admiral Rickover, who was the father of the nuclear navy, examined all the evidence, it was obvious that the explosion came from within, not from without. But they had to have an explanation, a justification for the war. They wanted to go to war. In fact, it was William Randolph Hearst who sent a note to a gentleman who was a photographer, and he said, you go to Cuba and you get the pictures and I'll supply the war. This was the attitude. They wanted the war. They wanted to begin moving towards an American empire. And, of course, when the defeat of Spain, why, now we had Cuba, we had Puerto Rico, we had the Mariana Islands, we had the Philippines, and America was starting on its way towards, empire. Now, admittedly, we, of course, turned the Philippines loose, but America's always dominated the Philippines ever since then. We've had our naval bases there, and American economic interests have controlled that country just exactly as American economic interests control Japan today. Isn't it interesting? We still have our troops stationed in Japan almost 60 years after the war ended. I mean, this is not happening by accident. The same thing is true with Germany. The whole idea was to create an empire, but never to let the American people know. Anything else you want to say, Bart?
I think that'll be it for me tonight, Stan. I'll let somebody else call in. Thank you very much for your program.
God bless, and thanks so much. Good to hear from you. All right, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. We'd love to hear from you. Give us a call right here at Radio Liberty. Well, Dr. Stan, and certainly then, of course, after the Spanish-American War ended in 1899, and that same year the Boer War began in South Africa, and that was, of course, the English extension of what we refer to today as the Anglo-American establishment. And of course, it was aimed entirely at defeating the Boers, bringing British control over the entire country of South Africa, and then uniting it, and then of course you would be able to begin uniting all of Africa. Well, of course, after this long and bloody war, and of course the British lost over 100,000 troops. Now, a lot of them died of disease and a lot of them were injured, but they had over 100,000 casualties, and the Boers only had 7,000 casualties. From the English won the war, but of course at a terrible, terrible cost. However, that didn't dissuade at all the secret society. Now, anybody who'd like to read the story of this, it's really laid out beautifully in the book Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in High Time. And if you haven't actually read that book, you need to get it, and you need to read it through very carefully, because here Professor Quigley tells of the background of the secret society that dominated the world during the early years of the 20th century and still dominates the world today. And that would be, of course, the secret society that Cecil Rhodes created. And Professor Quigley knew a great deal about this secret society because he had run into a man named Professor Zimmern, who had been part of the secret society. And Professor Zimmern was a professor of international law at Oxford University, and Professor Quigley was over in England doing research on the English establishment so he could try to understand how they worked and why things had happened, and trying to understand the First and Second World War, when Professor Zimmern told him, with a promise that he would never tell who had actually given him the information, that Professor Zimmern had been part of a secret society from about 1910 to 1921. He'd been part of the inner circle of this secret society, and that was what, of course, led Professor Quigley back to the secret society that Cecil Rhodes had created, and he did some marvelous research on it. And he put it all together, and he, of course, lists in his book Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, and in his book The Anglo-American Establishment, the background, and you can actually follow his footsteps as I did. It was really so interesting, as I got hold of the original manuscripts out of Professor Quigley's papers back at Georgetown University, and I went out and I bought up many of the books he referred to. That was the book, The Anglo-American Establishment. Well, the book came out about 1981. I was with Professor Quigley's papers in 1980. And a couple of years later, I tried to track down these books, and that all disappeared. You couldn't get them anyplace. And I realized I have probably one of the finest collections of the books that Quigley talked about that you'll find anyplace. Somebody simply destroyed all of those books, just exactly as they tried to destroy Professor Quigley's book. And actually, somebody came in and actually bought up Macmillan Company that published Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, and destroyed the place to the first half of the book. And if that story sounds incredible to you, we have an interview with Professor Quigley where he tells the story, and you can hear that in his own voice, telling about how somebody bought up Macmillan Company, destroyed the place to the first half of the book, and then lied to him for years, claiming they were going to republish the book when they had no intention of doing it. But you see, you're not supposed to know how they control our reality today, or you might begin to understand the truth about what I refer to as the Brotherhood of Darkness. Well, we'll be back here in just a moment to answer Tony's question. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. We're open lines at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, and it's a bad time to have it because they just changed our shortwave frequencies today, so we lost our whole shortwave audience. And of course, here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And of course, I was telling you about how Professor Quigley learned about the secret society from Professor Zimmern. And the Tony, who's doing the board tonight, asked, why did Professor Zimmern leave the secret society? Well, because Professor Zimmern had joined the secret society before the First World War. And, of course, at that time, France was the ally of Great Britain, and Germany and Austria-Hungary were the adversary that fought a terrible, bloody war. What you have to understand is that almost 100,000 men died every month during that four-year war. 8 million men died during that four-year war. 2 million a year, and somewhere between 1 and 200,000 men died every single month on both sides. It was a terrible, bloody war. Another 12 million civilians died, bringing the total up to over 21 million people died and twice that many injured. And, of course, it had destroyed the graduates of Harrow, a whole generation of the graduates of Harrow and Eton in England, of Oxford and Cambridge, and bankrupted the country. And then after this war, when, of course, France had been the ally of Great Britain and had fought valiantly, supposedly, for these ideas of bringing about this world government, that's what it was really all about. It was all about creating the League of Nations. But it was all this idealism, and then immediately after the war, this little secret society, Intercorps, of which Professor Zimmern was part of this, suddenly wanted to ally itself with Germany against France. And he thought that was wrong. I mean, after all, Germany was the enemy and France was the ally. And these people, of course, realized that there are no permanent allies, there are no permanent values and no permanent standards. Everything is about the ultimate goal, establishing the world government. And, of course, what Professor Zimmern may not have realized at all is the dark spiritual forces that has always energized this movement and the men who lead this movement, because many of these people truly have given themselves over to the dark side. And Professor Zimmern became so disillusioned with these people that he actually dropped out of the secret society. And although he was always aligned with it afterwards, he never was part of the inner core, because he really felt that these people, what they're doing was wrong. Now, he always believed in the idea of a world government. He just didn't want to continue working with them. And you'll find the story I've just told you in the book, The Anglo-American Establishment. You can index read it for Professor Zimmern, and you can find that story. Now, he doesn't tell you that... does he mention... Yes, he does actually mention Alfred Zimmern's name there. But he doesn't tell you that Alfred Zimmern is the man who actually told him about the secret society. But he gives you, you know, the clue there, because he said Alfred Zimmern was part of the secret society. Well, how did Professor know? Quigley know? Well, because Quigley had told him. How do I know? Because I've read through Quigley's papers, which I have, and in Quigley's papers it tells about, because Zimmern had given him the information that put him onto this whole incredible story. And then, of course, Professor Quigley was allowed to spend a whole year going through the records of the secret society in the early 1960s, and of course he gleaned a great deal more information, because he was an intellectual, because he was a college professor at Georgetown at the time and taught at both Harvard and Princeton. They felt he was one of theirs. He was in total sympathy with their ideas. But you see, as an honest historian, he felt that people had a right to know who it was who was really controlling what was going on behind the scenes. And so he, of course, puts all of this information in his book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, which is certainly one of the most amazing of all of the books that I have in my library. So, let's see, Tony is asking, how did Ruskin become Rhodes Professor? Or where did Ruskin become Rhodes Professor? Well, John Ruskin taught at Oxford University. He was a professor of art analysis, as I remember. What does a professor of art analysis have to do with Cecil Rhodes? Well, he would sort of combine this idea of art and politics and morality, he gave a lecture. It was the inaugural lecture, his annual inaugural lecture, Professor Ruskin's inaugural lecture at Oxford in 1870. And he talked about how it was the duty of the young aristocrats in England to bring English culture to the entire world. If they did not, eventually England would be destroyed. But this was a cause to live for, this was a cause to die for. What better way to bring about this one world government that he dreamed of? Now, Ruskin was a disciple of Plato. He read Plato on a daily basis. He was a very disturbed man, probably homosexual, deeply involved in the occult himself, and a disciple of Plato. And, of course, he then indoctrinated the youth of a generation in these ideas of one world government, but even more important than that, of course, his leading pupil, his leading disciple, was a young man named Cecil John Rhodes, for whom Rhodesia and the Rhodes Scholarships are named. Well, yeah, this is Dr. Stan back here, and if you're out there in the list in the across the country, why, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. If you're listening on the shortwave, please give us a call. Let us know what frequency you're listening to us. Of course, 5.835 megahertz. 5.835. We'll stay on 5.835. However, our other frequency, 7.535, has changed to 7.580. That's 7.5804 this hour. But anyway, the incredible story of Ruskin's influence on a whole generation of the youth of Great Britain and his influence there as a professor at Oxford University. I know when I went to Oxford and I talked to people about Ruskin, everybody knew about Ruskin. He'd been such a dominant force in Great Britain at that time, and a dominant force at Oxford. And of course, influence was felt not only at Oxford, but at Cambridge. And there were young men at Cambridge who joined together with the young men at Oxford and gave the whole of their lives to bring about this one world government, which was exactly what Plato had written about in his book, The Republic. But what most people do not understand is that Ruskin was deeply involved in the occult. Plato was involved in the occult. And Plato, of course, was the student of Socrates, who was a one generation removed from being a student of Pythagoras. And you read up on Pythagoras in your encyclopedia, you'll find out that Pythagoras, and you can remember his dictum on geometry, a squared plus b squared equals c squared, and that is the square of the two sides of a right angle triangle is equal to the square of the hypotenuse. That is a fundamental dictum of geometry. And that was put forward by Pythagoras, who lived about 500 years before B.C. Now, where did Pythagoras learn that? I mean, do you honestly think he sat down and said, you know, I've been thinking, I think that the square of the two sides of a right angle triangle is equal to the square of the hypotenuse of the right angle triangle. No, he'd gone to the Near East and he'd begin to study the mystery of religions, and it tapped into the secret knowledge that has always been there, a byproduct of the mystery of religions. And of course, these are demonic. Their origin comes in the very pit of hell, but there is great knowledge there that you can tap into. And then, of course, Pythagoras came back to Italy. At that time, of course, it was under Greek domination. He set up a school to teach the mystery of religions in the southern part of Italy. And then, of course, that ideas spread on. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we were simply going into the background of where Ruskin's ideas came from that he imparted to Cecil Rhodes, that became the secret society Rhodes created, which eventually formed here in the United States as the Council on Foreign Relations. But Rhodes got his ideas from Plato. Plato got his ideas from Socrates. Socrates got his ideas from Pythagoras, and Pythagoras was deeply involved in the mystery of religions. But then so was Socrates, and so was Plato, and so was Aristotle, and so was Aristotle's most famous student, a man named Alexander the Great. And we actually have in one of the books in my library, it's called The Life of Alexander, Plutarch's The Life of Alexander, and it's interpreted by, I believe it's Hively, or Kively, I think it's Hively, or anyway, anybody wants to get it, where Alexander's writing to Aristotle and condemning him for writing a book on the mystery religions and tapping into this secret knowledge. And Aristotle writes back to Alexander and says, you got nothing to worry about, Alexander, because unless you've been schooled in the mystery religions, you can read all you want to about it, you will never understand it. And what do you not understand? There are Luciferian forces you can tap into. There's another dimension you tap into. And of course, you'll get great power, as Alexander did, but of course, at the price of your eternal soul. Well, we've got all sorts of callers beginning to call in. We've got, let's see, is this Roger?
Yes, this is Roger from Henderson, Nevada, calling Dr. Stan.
Oh, fine. Are you on the shortwave coming in?
Yes, Dr. Stan.
Which frequency are you on?
I'm listening to you, Stan, on 5.835 megahertz down in Henderson.
All right, fine. They didn't change that one, so but they changed the other one, which was 7.535. That went up to 7.580. Anyway, do you have any question or comments you'd like to make?
No, that's basically about it. I just want to know what your new frequency is going to be, but I'm picking up on that 5.835, and also just want to say that newsletter last month and this month was very, very good. I just want to compliment on that. Keep on doing a good job and getting the truth out. I appreciate your program.
You're talking now about my review of John Perkins, The Confessions of an Economic Hitman?
Yes, I love that. That was really, really good.
Well, it's very good. Remember, John Perkins is really into he's very liberal. He's into the New Age. He's got a lot of crazy ideas, but I believe the information he put out in his book on how the elite work and how they've impoverished the people of the world is very, very accurate.
Oh, yes, it is. It's very, very accurate. It's actually going on right today, what's going on in our own workforces around the whole economy. It also affects people's lives individually. And it's good to get that news out to everybody. I appreciate it.
God bless you. Thanks very much for calling. And we've got Carol who's listening in Arkansas on shortwave. Hi, Carol. How are you doing?
Good evening, Dr. Stan.
And are you on the 5.835 frequency?
Yes, sir. Okay. Yes, sir. And it's coming in very nice this evening.
Good. I'm glad. Okay. Do you have a question or comment?
Well, I was going to tell you, I'll air it here since it hasn't been in the press. It probably will be tomorrow. I have somewhat of a heavy heart. I spent the day down at the state capitol. We're in session right now in Arkansas. And was speaking to a senator, and a newsman walked up, and he said, well, he asked this young man, because he has just taken a very hard hit from the governor for standing up against illegal immigration. And there's a bill in our House. It passed out of the House. Now it's gone to the Senate committee, and it's supposed to go out of the Senate committee very rapidly and will be on the floor of the Senate shortly. And it is the bill, it's entitled Access to Post-Secondary Education Act of 2005 and for other purposes. What this is, of course, is to fund illegal aliens with Arkansas taxpayer money to go to college.
Isn't that the craziest thing you ever heard?
It is absolute insanity. But while I was standing there talking to this conservative senator, this newsman walked up and he said, Senator, he said, I've just come from Lieutenant Governor Win Paul. Of course, he is Speaker in the Senate, and I was on the Senate side. But he said, I just came from Lieutenant when Paul Rockefeller's office, and he's announced that he told us that he's fixing to announce that he's going to run for governor of Arkansas.
Now, what's his relationship to Winthrop?
That's his son.
That's his son. Okay, for Winthrop.
And so we're going to have to fight off a Rockefeller house here. and I just hope every Christian out there will pray for the citizens of Arkansas that they will have the wisdom not to do this thing. And of course, they're going to have a lot of money as opposed to anybody else. You know, they'll be able to pour however much they want in there. But it's very, very sad what is happening to our state. And
well, I didn't really realize that the Winthrop son was there. Winthrop had the largest collection of pornography anywhere in the world. But what people have to understand is that the Rockefeller family as a whole has been deeply involved in the occult for many, many years. In fact, it goes all about the way to John D. Rockefeller, who actually, of course, I've forgotten whether it was he or his son, who actually bought the site where the United Nations stands today. And it was an occult site. There's a wonderful book written by Robert Mueller, a longtime Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations, a man who, of course, belongs to the Lucis Trust, used to be the Lucifer Publishing House, a man who is totally dedicated to this idea of the occult world government. And he tells in his book, The First Lady of the World, about that site where the Rockefellers placed the United Nations. It was an occult area, in fact. It had special significance because it had been used for slaughterhouses, and the blood of literally hundreds of thousands, if not millions of cows, had soaked into the sand there. What a wonderful site to build the United Nations on. And, of course, this is, there was an ancient Indian ritual site having to do with Indian occult beliefs and practices. And everything ties into the occult, but the average American has no idea. that the Rockefeller fortune has been used for, you know, for 150 years, pushing the world occult agenda, the New World Order, the New World Religion.
Well, I hope that people listening from Arkansas will call their state senators and ask them to please vote against this Post-Secondary Education Act of 2005 funding illegal aliens in our colleges.
Well, did you ever ask yourself why we're doing everything we can to encourage illegal immigration? It really doesn't make any sense. Why would the Ford Foundation, for instance, be funding organizations like LULAC and MALDAVE, which are funding their organizations for illegal immigrants? I mean, an illegal immigrant's a person who's broken our laws, and yet they're being funded, and their organizations are being funded by the Ford Foundation. And it should be obvious, it doesn't matter whether the Democrats or Republicans are in power. They have intentionally allowed illegal immigration. You know, I was watching a movie the other night, and it was the story of what England was like during the Roman occupation there. You know, I guess it was even before Christ was born. And they built a great wall all across the entire nation of Great Britain to keep the barbarians in the north. I think the movie was called King Arthur or Arthur, but they showed this great wall that had been built, and I remember it had been built. The Romans were able to build a wall all the way across the border there. The Chinese built a wall that was thousands of miles long in about 2 or 3 years to keep out the invaders from Mongolia. But America, with all of its technology and its bulldozers and its cranes, we can't construct a wall down there. And the truth of the matter is, they do not want to keep the people out. They want them to come into this country, and they want to them because they really want to destroy this nation. This is part of what it's all about.
Exactly. There's right.
No better way to destroy a nation than bring in people with a different language, with a different culture,
and
people who hate America. Many of them do. Now, some of them are good people, and they want to be here, and they want to be good citizens, and
but
they want to become Americans.
Those have applied for a citizenship, Dr. Stan. The majority of these people do not want to take out a citizenship. They want to maintain their citizenship in Mexico, and essentially they are dual citizenry because they send their paychecks home every Friday when they get paid. They go to the bank. It does not recirculate in our economy here, which, you know, they say it. If you cash your check, it goes into at least seven, turns over at least seven different times in the economy locally. Well, theirs doesn't turn over at all because they send it straight to Mexico. And we can't seem to get this into some of the people's head down at the state senate, but our governor, who is a so-called Baptist preacher, really lambasted this senator the other day from the House floor when they were passing over in the House, because he had sponsored this bill against this on the Senate side, and he called him unchristian and that he was bigoted and prejudiced and I mean, all kinds of unkind things, and if you ask me, it was the governor who was bigoted and prejudiced, because he's saying that, you know, tax-paying, law-abiding citizens here have no rights, only the illegal ones.
You think, I have to understand, Carol, that these people cannot defend their treasonous acts, so they have to demonize the people who are trying to do what's right. And if you take a stand today for justice and for America and for patriotism, you're going to be attacked and demonized. And I hope that you gave this young man who had the courage to stand up all the encouragement you can. Because believe me, these people, these wicked people, they control the media. And they buy off governors all across this country. They buy off legislators. If they can't, of course, buy up the newspapers, they bribe the people there. They control the major media outlets. And those of you who have not yet read Professor Ben Bagdakian's book, The New Media Monopoly, need to get a copy. Five mega corporations dominate the American people, dominate the American media today, and control what the American people think. The average American doesn't understand that. And, of course, all they hear is what they are being told by the controlled media. But this is really what we're up against. The whole thing, America is being invaded today. They want to destroy this country because we were once a Christian nation. And is there any better way than to create this massive movement, and probably once these people become, of course, given permanent residence here, why, they'll be able to bring in their families, so we will actually bring in about 50 million more people with dual citizenship with no loyalty to America, and then you can play the Hispanic against the white, and the black against the white, and the black against the Hispanic, and that's really what it's all about.
I think they're really setting it up for anarchy and for the wars in between those, because, you know, the blacks don't work well with the Hispanics. They don't want them up here. They look at them as taking their jobs right now. So it's only going to grow worse. But I'd like to also break another little piece of news on your show, Dr. Stan. I was standing at the same time speaking with former state U.S. Senator Tim Hutchison, and his brother-in-law is in our Senate, and I said, you know, are we going to have to endure Governor Rockefeller, or now Lieutenant Governor Rockefeller, is he going to run for governor? And I was quite certain he would. I mean, you know, his orders are coming from on high after all. But they tell me that Asa Hutchinson is also going to run against him in the primary. So Arkansas needs a lot of prayer from a lot of people. We have a Governor Huckabee who has sold out to the New World Order. He told me, I took documents to him, Dr. Stan, shortly after he became governor. I worked for him because we had Clinton before. After all, it was the worst situation down there. But I took documents to him showing him how they were going about foisting the legislation on the states with the suggested legislation from the American Legislative Exchange. I took him their documents, what they said, how they were doing it and what they were doing, and he looked at me straight-faced and said, Carol, I do not believe in any conspiracy theories or any New World Order. And so, I was so disappointed in this man, who's a Baptist minister, supposed to know what the gospel says about there being a one-world government. It didn't even occur to me to say, well, you know, you just call God a liar. But well, that's in essence what he did.
Well, if you could get him to read a copy of my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, but then probably, I don't know what's in his heart, but I've been so disappointed with the Governor Huckabee. We thought he was going to be really true to his calling as a minister, but I guess he's got a different color. He's probably listening to a different voice. Because, of course, the whole idea of everything going on today is to unite the United States with the entire North American continent, probably the entire Western Hemisphere. Unite that into one major block, initially trading block, then currency block, then government, and then we'll do the same thing with Asia, and we've got the same thing in place in Europe, and then we can unite them all together into this world government. And, it, of course, eventually the leader of this is going to be the Antichrist. And I read the Luciferian publications put out by the Lucius Trust, and the latest one we got is talking about how wonderful the United Nations is. Now, why would people who worship Lucifer think the United Nations is so great? I read Share magazine put out by Benjamin Krem, who calls himself sort of the John the Baptist for the Christ. The world leader, Maitreya is the name he goes by, but of course he's also the Christ of the Christians, the Messiah of the Jews, the Mahdi of the Muslims, I've forgotten the name that they give to the one who's to lead the Hindus. Oh, it's Maitreya, of course, the one who's going to lead the Hindus. So, and of course they talk how wonderful, of course, this whole idea is of world government. And they will tell you quite openly that the days of American being a major nation are very, very limited. America's about to be destroyed. Isn't that wonderful? These people really want the destruction of America. It appears like we've got a lot of people like Huckabee exactly want the same thing. Why would you want to reward people for coming to this country illegally? Why would you want to give them free medical care and bankrupt our medical system? Why would you want them to come in and with the diseases that they have? Why would you encourage people to come to this country illegally? Why would you demand that their children be given free education in our schools? Well, the only reason is you want to destroy America. And when you understand that, it all makes sense.
Exactly. And I want to say that this fine Christian young senator, who's a new one up there, he has not been there, you know, before, and they are just working him over terribly. And he is standing up, and he told me out there today, he said, I've made up my mind. I don't care. I'm not going to worry about getting a reelection. When I vote, I'm going to vote strictly on principle and what is right. and I don't care if I don't get reelected. He said, I'm going to have to answer the Lord for this. And so I said, well, so are they. And they've all been told that, but they don't acknowledge it. And one of the other connections, you were talking about the roots of all this. I've been doing a Bible study on the Bible versions and where they all came from. And I found something very interesting. You know, you talk about, in fact, you have the will and last will and testament of John Cecil Rhodes.
Right.
And he talks about his hatred, really, for the United States and how he hopes for its downfall. Well, I found out that Westcott and Hort, who rewrote the King James Version, they call it the New King James Version of the Bible, Westcott and Hort were also contemporaries with Cecil Rhodes.
Right, and they're deeply involved in the occult.
And yes, and Westcott also said he prayed daily for the downfall of the United States. He absolutely hated it. So they were contemporaries.
And they made the Greek translation,
they took Origins. Took Origins' version and lied about it. They said they had used the Textus Receptus when in fact they did not.
We're going to be back. Hang on here. We'll get just a few minutes more. Just hang on. Carol is calling from all places, Arkansas. We'll be right back in just a moment to wrap up the program. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest. Didn't show up this evening. He got laryngitis. So we've got Carol, and of course she's talking about the new Bible versions. What people do not understand is that the people who were instrumental in some of the new Bible versions and in writing the Greek dictionary that so many of our ministers used were Westcott and Hort. And Westcott and Hort came from Cambridge. They were involved in the occult. What better way to begin to undermine Christianity than from within? And
yes.
They were just like boll weevils. They got in there, and they've been gnawing away at the very foundations of our Bible and our belief. And even though they're long since dead and gone to their just rewards, at least I hope they have, why, of course, their influence is still here, and the average person, the average minister, has no idea that Westcott and Hort were instrumental in bringing about these new Bible versions.
Yes,
of
they
course,
were very
they
involved
to destroy
in the
Christianity,
occult.
Right? Go ahead.
Yeah, they were very involved in the occult. They belonged to a group called the Ghostly Guild, which did seances and stuff. They also were cavorters with Madame Helen Blavatsky. Mr. Westcott and Mr. Hort, neither one believed in the Trinity. They believed in universal salvation, including that was one of Origen's doctrines, by the way. And he wrote the false version of the Bible of the text that Westcott and Hort actually used, and they swore all the members on that board to secrecy that they were not using the received text or the Textus Receptus majority text. And Dr. Pribnary Scribner, who was very highly revered in English in England in biblical circles and has been ever since, before he died, told that they had been sworn to secrecy to not tell that, in fact, Westcott and Hort had been using the majority of what he wrote. They did use Textus Receptus in some places, so I guess that made them not totally liars, so they could tell themselves they weren't total liars about it, but they had used Origen's text, and of course Origen's the one who came up with the doctrine of purgatory, and he also believed in universal salvation, even that Satan would be saved. He believed in reincarnation. A lot of heresies, and the early church looked on his version. They looked on him as a heretic, and of course Eusebius, who was his follower, he was mentored by Origen, wrote those like 50 copies for Constantine of the Bible, and that's where they melded a lot of the pagan beliefs into to draw in all groups of people. And isn't that kind of what we're seeing happen in the church growth movement?
Absolutely, and we're going to have to let you go. Carol, God bless you. Thanks so much. Keep in touch, and please get other people down there listening. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I always sort of enjoy open lines, and it's always nice when we have callers. But anyway, of course, this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and if you're out there listening to us, we hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And then I want to mention once again that we're well on our way now to, as far as our effort to get people to take these full cases of Brotherhood of Darkness. If you're interested in getting a case of 62 Brotherhood of Darkness books, why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927, because we're going to do a major printing if we can, of course, get enough people to get the cases of books. Why, of course, we can print a lot more, and that, of course, is very good for you, and it's good for us as well. It really will help Radio Liberty. But what I really hope is that you'll get those copies of the book and get them into people's hands, so they can understand there truly are demonic forces there. And there really are people who worship the devil. And many of them are in very, very key positions in the world today. So if you're interested in knowing more about getting the case of books with 62 copies of Brotherhood of Darkness, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. I don't know of a better weapon that we have right now at this time in our history than that. And then, of course, there's so many other things. If you've been reading the latest issue, and I think it's either Time or Newsweek magazine, it's all about autism. But, of course, we can assure you that autism is not related to the vaccines and certainly not related to mercury. And the last thing you want to do is treat your child. The only trouble is it is related to mercury, and if you treat them early enough, you can reverse this. So they're going to do a study. Of course, you want to treat them before they're three. So they're going to do a study of children 3 to 9, knowing full well that this will not be effective, because they don't want you to know that there really is hope for autistic children. They've done so much damage. Of course, they're intentionally leaving the mercury in the childhood, in the influenza vaccine, and it's even still in the childhood vaccines. They say there's only a trace in there, but they don't tell you how much trace is a trace. How does it get there in there anyway? I mean, how do they get the thimerosal into the childhood vaccines? Why are they putting it in at all and then having to take it out? A lot of unanswered questions. They certainly don't put it in the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine. They say just be careful when you use the multi-dose vial, but they put it in the other vaccine, saying, oh, we have to have it in there as a sterilizer so that it won't be contaminated. So why is it all right to have multi-dose vials of MMR, where if you put the thimerosal in, you'd kill the viruses, the attenuated viruses, and it's not all right, and it is all right, of course, to put the thimerosal in the other vaccines? Well, I think that there is an agenda. I think they know what they're doing, and I think that there are people out there who really want to destroy the minds of our children. For as Bertrand Russell had said so well, by diet, injections, and injunctions, we will be able to control the minds and the character of our children. So remember our telephone number. It's 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. We do hope that many of you may want to get the video, the 3-hour, the 4-hour, the 10-hour version of They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll. We, of course, have Megiddo 1, Megiddo 2. My new video entitled None Dare Call It Genocide. We have the new video that Bill Sardi has put together where he talks about the drug manufacturers and what they're doing to poison our people. And then, of course, and believe me, ladies and gentlemen, the original studies of IARC showed a 7-fold increase in the incidence of heart disease. They're telling you devils know, a 7-fold increase in the incidence of heart disease and complications. Taking the Vioxx, they knew that before they put it on the market back in 1999. If you've read Dr. Graham's testimony, you need to get the facts. You need to understand what they're doing to our people. So pray for America. Pray for revival. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you.